This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Betsy Bennett has recently celebrated, or has been celebrated, for two decades as the head of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. She was responsible for bringing a dinosaur to North Carolina, creating the new wing of the museum, and making it the number one field trip destination in the state. And that just names a few of her successes. But before her involvement with the museum, Betsy spent a lot of her time teaching and struggling for equality in the school system. It's Betsy's long history as an educator, mover, and shaker in the South that brought her to the Triangle. Betsy Bennett retired as the director of the North Carolina Museum for Natural Sciences in December of 2012, and she joins us on the program today. Welcome to the program, Betsy. Good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here.
And we're going to talk all about this wonderful new wing of the museum and the old wing, which is not that old, and its contribution to the state. But I want you to take us back to your earliest days in Birmingham, Alabama, where I understand you were somewhat of an explorer yourself.
Well, when I was a young child, I spent a lot of time outdoors, damming up creeks and building tree houses in the woods, particularly with my sister and my brother, and exploring in the mountains of Alabama. So, yeah.
We've sort of had your first brush with science in nature itself.
Sure.
Which is the best way to get it. Did you decide, you've been an educator one way or another most of your life. When did you decide that that's the field you wanted to pursue?
I guess when I was a child, I always, for some reason, thought I would be a teacher. Women back in those days didn't have the myriad of options that women do today in terms of role models. But I always thought I'd be a teacher. And when I was a kid outdoors, I would play being a teacher. So I guess it was part of my destination.
You had to leave Birmingham to go to Hollins College. Is that right?
Correct.
And so tell us about that and what kind of a change that was for you, or was it?
Well, it was great going off to a fabulous school. Hollins College is now Hollins University, and it's an all-women's college. And I had the opportunity to take creative writing as well as major in physics and math, and it was just a great school where I could play sports as well as get involved in academics.
Did you miss Birmingham?
Well, you know, we back in those days, we'd go back in the summertime. So, you know, when you go off to college, or at least I did, I felt like a whole new world had opened up for me. So I loved being at Hollins and meeting new friends. And we used to ride the train back and forth from Virginia to Birmingham. And
Whole new world in terms of career as well. You talked about, you know, growing up, not a lot of role models for things other than teaching, nursing, those traditional fields that were open then to women. Then you get to college. Did you start thinking about other possibilities then?
Well, I did, but I did, though, my senior year at Hollins, did student teaching. So I taught at the nearby high school, Lord Botetourt High, and I taught physics and had my students building rockets out and launching them on the football field. And I actually thought about going on to graduate school to get a PhD in physics right after Hollins, but I decided I wanted to try working and go teach school. So I went back and taught at the high school from where I'd graduated in Birmingham, and that was really cool. I had a lot of cousins in my class, and, of course, I was very familiar with that school, and it was great going back to the high school from where you graduated and being a teacher there.
You're in charge. You have some authority now.
Right. Yeah, it was fun.
Back to a segregated school system
right.
At the time. Where was your social consciousness at the time?
Alabama at that time was a segregated society. Mm. And I was working in that society, and it was kind of the way it was, but it was not right. I had been to Virginia and knew there were integrated schools in Virginia And so it was something that I knew needed to be corrected.
And your family was progressive in its ideas about integration.
They were. And, you know, I grew up in a family that valued education. And they thought it was important for everyone to be educated and everyone to have access to education. So it was an emphasis in my family. All of us assumed we were going off to college, and we did. And my mom actually had been a kindergarten teacher before she'd gotten married. So education was a big part of our upbringing.
Did you feel in those earliest days as a teacher, because, you know, you sort of have to, you know, paint the picture here of people brought up in an environment where this is what we do. The schools are segregated. The black schools are here. The white schools are there. And then kind of slowly coming to a consciousness. And then did you feel you had to do something about it? Or was that, did that take some time to come?
Well, it was interesting. You know, once Walter and I got married, we moved to North Carolina. And I taught in integrated schools in North Carolina. And then we moved on to Virginia and taught in integrated schools in Virginia. And they were actually very well-managed schools, and there was not a lot of tension in those schools, and we had a real strong faculty. So it was not a hard transition for me at all. When I was in Charlottesville, I think one of the injustices I saw is that they had after-school sports for guys, but they didn't have it for women, and so I started the after-school sports program for Buford Middle School in Charlottesville. And we had a great time playing softball and basketball and competing with schools in the area. That was fun getting that started.
Birmingham schools did integrate while you were there, and I guess they began with the teachers, right? That was the
Well, that was more in Virginia. Alabama came along after that. And so when I was in Charlottesville, the University of Virginia had a program, and they asked for some of the teachers to apply for a program to go into newly integrated schools that actually were having trouble. So I was one of the teachers selected to be trained. There were about 25 or 30 of us black and white teachers that actually had successful careers in integrated schools, but we needed additional training to go into newly integrated schools to work with teachers to discuss what their concerns were, help alleviate some of the tension in the faculties. And that was a great experience.
Well, tell us about what were those tensions and how do you address them?
Well, I think there's, when you integrate schools, not only is there the racial issue, but there are cultural education differences. For instance, what I learned is that many of the all-black schools in Virginia were very strict schools. They were lots of discipline in those schools, whereas in the all-white schools, it was more relaxed. So when you combine those two education cultures, that was different. So we would go in teams. There would be four or six teachers that would go into these newly integrated schools, and the team would be integrated, and we would sit around with the faculty of those schools after school and just talk about issues. And sometimes all it took was sitting down and having the freedom to have discussions about your concerns. And what is you find out is that really there are not that many differences, you know, and you just have to learn what the different cultures are and how you work with that. And so often, you know, it felt really good after you'd been there working with the faculty for a few days and the tension would relax. and people were communicating better with each other. So it's all about communicating and understanding where the other person is coming from.
And you can certainly see how that would relieve tensions just to have these conversations,
right.
Get it out. And that's one thing. Now, the other thing you hear so much about, in fact, you still hear about it today, is an assumption, sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle, on the part of white teachers usually about black students, their ability or willingness to learn. And you sort of have to address that. Was that anything that came up in these discussions?
Well, of course, you know, all students want to learn. All students. And what, you know, our job as a society is to give access to all kids. So some students come to school without as much parental support. And that is a key factor in success in school. So you need to spend time learning about your students. And, you know, one of the things that was great in the after-school programs that I did, you know, I really got to know my students really well, and that transferred into the classroom. But again, you just have to have the assumption that every student wants to learn. And once you know that and believe that, then you just need to be the facilitator for that learning.
Betsy Bennett's my guest, was the director of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences for more than 20 years, retired in December 2012, and our conversation continues on the state of things. From North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Betsy Bennett, retired director of the North Carolina Museum of Sciences, and now with us today, looking back on some of that, and I know there's a lot more good stuff to come, but let's talk about when you went back to Birmingham for a while and taught, and then found yourself at some point in Charlotte, North Carolina. How'd you get there?
Well, after we were in Charlottesville getting degrees, Walter getting his law degree, and I was getting my master's degree in teaching, then we then came to Charlotte so he could be in a small law firm in Charlotte. So I also had just had a new baby, so I was going to stay home, but didn't do that very long. Went back and taught school in Charlotte. Helped start a street academy for middle school dropouts, and that was a really fun experience.
Well, tell us about that, about the street academy, and what the criteria, what was the theory behind that?
Well, I was involved just in the pilot program with my friend Jane Corey, and we just had a few students to begin with, about 20 to 30 students. She taught the English and history subjects. I taught the science and math subjects. And the school system had identified middle school students that had dropped out and were not coming to school regularly. So we opened this school for those students to see if we can give them some personalized attention to get them more involved in their education. So we did that for a semester.
And tell us about it. When would this have been?
So this would have been back in March of 72 through June of 73. So we started that for—actually, I think it was March of 73 to June of 73. It just went for a semester. And then because of the success of that pilot program, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools decided that they would have a full-fledged street academy and involve a lot more students. So that started the following year.
And talk about that success, and because this is a little different than just integrating a school. You're talking now about kids who have already demonstrated some problems. They're having some trouble.
Right.
They haven't really tested for any learning disabilities,
right.
But they're starting to fall behind. And so I guess the theory is, well, let's catch them before this gets any worse.
Right. So the concept is give them some personal attention, have small classes, find out what their skills are, and go from where their level of learning is to a higher level of learning. And so that was kind of what Jane and I were working on. And we found out that we did have success with these kids because they came to school every day, which is, you know, was one measure of success, which they had not been doing. So then the following, because of that pilot program, then the school board decided that they would have a full-fledged street academy that would run all year. And I think they started out with 100 students and built on that. And again, they had hired teachers that were really good with personalizing education for students, and they had a really good principal.
Well, so but tell us what happened to that when they scaled it up.
Well, so it scaled up and it was successful for a number of years. And I think after I left Charlotte and we went back to Charlottesville, the school became actually a dumping ground for problem students rather than the original need, which was working with middle school students that had lost interest and then dropped out. So it changed the whole tenor of the school. So, and that's a different kind of school. So I think, you know, after it opened about 10 years later, they decided not to have the street academy anymore. But that was after I left Charlotte.
That's interesting because the model you described and the methods you described sound like what should be called OSE school mm-hmm. and not a special school or,
right,
or
right.
a pilot school. Right.
Right,
I mean,
right.
this is how... what we should be doing. Why aren't we doing that?
I don't know. You know, I think there are lots of great efforts in magnet schools in the Wake County school system. I think after I ran the Street Academy, we started a school within a school at West Charlotte High School. Another friend of mine, Maggie Ray, and I started that and several others of us help start that school within a school, and it just had a more flexible curriculum, and it was working with some of these at-risk students within that school. And again, it was a successful model and continued for a while.
So there you are in Charlotte working at the building level, building programs, creating programs that worked for a while. And this is about the same time that Charlotte is grappling with a way to implement the decision on the Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board case. First of all, tell us about that case.
Well, the school board of Charlotte had... developed a pupil assignment plan two times, and it had gone to the Supreme Court and been denied. And it was denied, I think, because of lack of fairness. So the citizens of Charlotte, particularly the parents, were tired of having different pupil assignment plans every year. They didn't know exactly where their kids were going to go from one year to the other. So again, my friend Maggie Ray and I pulled together a citizens advisory group made up of parents from all across Mecklenburg County. And we thought, well, we would come together and, again, talk about what the concerns are. What were the issues? Could we come up with guidelines for how a plan ought to be developed? So we met over dinner for three evenings. And in the South, you know, you don't have major conflicts over dinner. You have good conversations. And again, some of them were heated, but we came to the consensus that we could come up with a fair and stable plan. And we presented our concepts to the school board, and they said, fine, thank you very much. But
if we want to hear from you parents, we'll ask for your
right. Opinions. And so then we went to the federal judge, Judge McMillan, to ask if we could present a plan to the court. And he actually said yes.
Wow.
And gave us the authority to work with the administrators in the school system to come up with a plan, which we spent a year doing. And we presented to the court, and it was accepted.
First of all, about how many members of the citizens group did you put
So there were about 30, yeah. 30 of us, and we met regularly for, you know, several nights a week for almost a year because there was a lot of information. And the whole tenet was we wanted to be fair, and that meant everybody participated in the pupil assignment plan. There weren't major neighborhoods that were left out. And we didn't want children on long bus rides. So again, there were lots of heated discussions, but we always came to consensus at the end of the day and were able to come up with a plan that was stable for 10 years.
And I really want to get a picture of this. You have 30 members off and on, but about how many would show up at an average
meeting? Oh, we were all there.
All 30 of you there?
Yeah, because people were representing their neighborhoods. And so this was black and white representatives from neighborhoods all across the county. So you did not show up because you had a vested interest in what that plan was going to be, and you had your areas depending on you being the voice, being the advocate for that part.
But what authority did you have? Because the school board, again, I mean...
But the Judge McMillan gave us the authority. He said, this group will come up with a plan and present it to the school board and to the court, which we did. And it was the plan that was finally accepted in the Swine case.
And that was a plan that was working pretty well for a while.
Right, it was. Yeah. And, you know, you always have to, when you've got a major, a large school system, population shifts, new neighborhoods are built, so you have always got to go in and manage and adjust. And so you've always got to relook, you know, 10 years down the road or...
When you see what's going on in Wake County, do you think that that's the kind of plan that could work there?
Well, I think the citizens want a stable plan, and I think they want something resolved that's fair. So, sure, I think it would be a great strategy.
What was the political climate in Charlotte like at the time?
Charlotte was a very progressive town to live in. You know, we had Harvey Gantt was mayor. Some of my friends were on the city council and on the county commission. A number of us were on the school board, and it was a very great time. Once the, particularly in education, once the people assignment plan was developed, when I was on the school board, we really could focus on improving education. So we spent the 6 years that I was on the school board, we spent a lot of our time asking for improved programs, and people were coming in presenting new ideas. And so it was a very exciting time to be in Charlotte. Charlotte was growing and they were managing growth. They passed 3 bond issues during the time that I was there. And some of that was for Discovery Place where I ended up working. So it was an exciting time to be in Charlotte.
Let me get this straight. If you get a grassroots public group, a public interest group, or not a public interest group, but a grassroots parents group to work on student assignment for you, then the school board can actually spend time thinking about education.
Absolutely.
How about that?
Yeah, that was really great.
And you were on the school board at the time. And that is when you started working in science museums, Discovery
right,
Place.
Because I couldn't teach in the school because I was on the school board. So I had been involved in raising funds for Discovery Place when they were and then was hired to be the physics and chemistry developer of the exhibits, those exhibits at Discovery Place. And so that was really fun. And we opened Discovery Place, and in the morning I would dress up like Madame Curie, and in the afternoon I'd raise money and write grants.
So that unrealized desire to become a physics professor and a PhD somehow finds its way into Discovery Place. What about the fundraising part of it? Was that new for you?
That was new. Of course, when I ran for school board, you know, you do have to do some fundraising when you're campaigning, but it's minor compared to what you have to do now. So I had some experience in that, but that was a new experience for me at Discovery Place. I wrote grants, helped raise money for Discovery Place through grant funding and getting people involved, and that was fun.
Well, and apparently you were pretty good at it.
Well, I enjoy doing it.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about that, because a lot of people, they love their job and whatever it is, their science or their radio or their whatever they're doing, but man, please don't ask me to raise money for this thing. But well, you seem to, you do enjoy it.
Well, I do, because funding helps a lot of good things happen. So when you're working in a school or when you're working in a museum and you want to do a really cool program and you need additional funding for it, so in my mind, it's not hard to ask money for it because really good things are going to happen. And you can help people get excited about making those good science programs happen.
And you also have to be able to really express that vision. So what it is you're seeing has to then find its way into the mind of the donor
in order for that
vision to become reality. And the Discovery Place was in the vanguard of that kind of museum, much more community-based, much more hands-on.
Right, exactly. And so it was one of the – it shortly became one of the leading science museums in the country. Because it had a lot of interactive exhibits and a lot of exciting programs. And it was a great place for me to learn how museums, science museums work and get involved into that whole museum culture. And it's interesting because when you're involved in a museum, you meet other museum educators and researchers all across the country because it's not a large community. And so you get to know folks doing the same job all over.
There were people all over the country, and I'm sure that you met those people and they helped develop the Discovery Place. But how much of that talent for this new idea, for really developing this new idea of a more interactive, hands-on museum, how much of it was already there in Charlotte and how much of a desire and impetus was there right there in Charlotte for this kind of a place?
Well, there was actually a movement across the country there have been great science museums in America for hundreds of years. And the movement was to make them more interactive, more visitor-friendly. And so Discovery Place was one of those science centers, one of the first ones that did that. You know, you've got the Exploratorium in San Francisco, and there were other models. And now there are lots of interactive science museums across the country. And again, it's just when you understand how people learn, how students and adults learn, a lot of the way they learn best is through engagement. And so what you want in a science museum are opportunities for visitors to engage in science activities. And that's why we would have short plays where when I was Madame Curie, you know, it was a kind of a 15-minute show, and I'd be dressed up in my long back dress and my lace collar talking about how she discovered radium. And I had a lot of props in there and got the visitors engaged in those activities while I was doing the program.
So. And your performance received glowing reviews. I'm sorry. Forgive me, please. So, but this is also, you know, you have to think, you began thinking about this and had been for a while. It's not just the oh, wow factor of how do we get them in here? Well, let's have them play with the birds. It's that people will learn this way. And in fact, that's the subject of your dissertation, right? Museums
right.
as places to learn.
Right, right. And, you know, when you've taught school a lot, you know that students learn lots of different ways. Some students are good at reading. Some students learn through hearing. But all students learn a lot through participation because they can use all those skills. So you are able to get students at any level that they bring to you. So, and they can figure out, you know, what is the connection. So what you're trying to do is, yes, get them excited by the wow, but then engage them.
And that's when you went back to school to get your doctorate? And tell us about that. You went and where did you go?
So I went back to UVA. I already had my master's, and I went back to UVA to get my PhD and in science education and really study how people learn in science museums. So I spent time in the Virginia Science Center as well as Discovery Place observing behaviors and again, unsurprising to me and to many others, you often are most engaged when you're having a conversation with somebody on the floor and they're helping you. So it's a personal interaction. There are lots of interactive ways to engage with the exhibits, but when you have that personal interaction with a researcher or an educator, it extends your learning.
This is what's great about you. You not only do you go in and do the thing, oh, come up with a model, but you don't go into Charlotte and teach. You come up with a model program, and then when it turns out that they're not integrating the schools quickly enough, you come up with a citizens group that comes up with a plan, and then you take off into the museum and say, oh, but how is this working? I know. I'll go back to school and figure it out, and thankfully came to Raleigh to help us all figure it out, and we'll find out more about what we've learned and how we've benefited from Betsy Bennett, who is the director of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences for more than 20 years before her retirement last December. Our conversation continues on the state of things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Betsy Bennett, just recently retired as director of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. So tell us about that, coming from Charlotte to Raleigh, and when did you get connected to the museum here?
So I came to the Museum of Natural Sciences in 1990, and that was in August. And
It was in a different place then.
It was a different place then. It, you know, the museum itself is now 133 years old. So it was a venerable natural history museum. It housed the collections that documents what lives or has lived in North Carolina. And so it had a fabulous staff and it had fabulous collections, but it needed a new museum. It was crowded. The school children would line outside the door getting in. And so the
and
general...
Where was it?
So it was actually right next door to where it is now. It was in the agriculture building, 3 feet from where the main museum is now. And we'd been housed in the agriculture annex. It was about 40,000 square feet. We're now in 200,000 square feet. So, but, you know, it had a lot of cool stuff. So school kids loved to come. We had the snake called George, which has a story, long story. But when I got there, we needed a new home. And the General Assembly and the governor knew we needed a new home. So funds were appropriated to build the main museum. And what the staff needed to do was develop the exhibits that would go inside that museum.
Is it a tough sell? Because it's going to, you know, the need might be obvious to everybody, including all those lawmakers from far-flung counties who might say, why am I spending all this money in Raleigh?
It was not a tough sell. Because their school children from every county, you know, came to Raleigh. And the Museum of Natural Sciences is one of the places their schools. We actually had lots of letters from school kids that went to legislators saying we need a new Museum of Natural Sciences. So we actually had across-the-board support for the new museum. And so my job was to work with the Friends of the Museum to raise money for the exhibits. And work with the staff to plan those exhibits, and that's such a creative process.
I want to hear more about that, but now I have to hear George's story.
Okay, so George was a python brought back to North Carolina from Vietnam, and a soldier brought George back and decided he really couldn't keep it in his house, so he brought it to the museum. So the museum created this big cage that was in the round. And he became one of the icon exhibits at the museum. And so a lot of people tell me about remembering George mm-hmm. when they came on their school visit to the museum. George eventually died of reptilian cancer and was sent to the Smithsonian for research. And then we got another, people missed the big python. So we got another one named Hapi. And when we moved into the new museum, we had lots of native snakes rather than snakes that were not from North
Carolina. Exotic species,
so,
right?
So.
That poor George, reptilian cancer, because perhaps you brought some of your Madame Curie exhibit with you and left them in the herpetarium?
No, no.
All right.
So,
I'm going to find out more about this because this is fascinating. You talked about this just a second ago. There's the fundraising piece, but it means talking to lawmakers who are mostly on board, as you say. The kids are writing letters. That's helpful. You have to get donors, and I think the ratio of in terms of the commitment by the end, I think $56 million
So the new wing, the main museum was a $75 million project. About two-thirds of that was appropriated funds from the state of North Carolina. So we raised about $25 million outside of the state for the main museum. And the new wing was a $56 million project, and we raised $34 million outside of state government for that project. So there were a lot of people that care about the Museum of Natural Sciences. So I came to an institution that people really cared about, and they wanted it to be better. And we had support from the General Assembly. Governor Hunt was very supportive. And we then went out and raised money all across North Carolina. And so we had corporations and individuals stepping up to make the exhibits happen, and it was just fabulous.
But not only that, you have to get – so you're bringing all those pieces together. But as you say, you're changing the model, so now it has to be more interactive. You have to find and or train people to be that docent, to be that person on the floor, right, to engage. And then I guess science teachers, if they're going to bring the kids – so many teachers afraid of science that it would seem to me that part of the mission too is to help – teachers overcome their fear of science and learn ways to use the museum when they bring their kids there.
Sure. Sure. So we have a, and for many years, over 20 years, have had an emphasis on educating teachers about science and the environment. And we actually reach out all across North Carolina with programs, and we go into communities across North Carolina, but we pay particular emphasis on providing opportunities for teachers. So we have an Educators of Excellence program where we, teachers, it's a competitive program. Teachers, we take them across North Carolina for week-long field trips, or we take them to Ecuador, Peru, for unique experiences. And many of those experiences have been funded with private donations. So we've had many people support the Educators of Excellence program. The concept is to give teachers unique experiences with the environment so that they can learn how to learn about the environment and they can take that back to their classroom. And it's just very successful. So we have a whole network of teachers across North Carolina who take advantage of our programs. We do distance learning. We now, with the SECU Daily Planet, we can go into every classroom in North Carolina with science programming. So we reach out and we provide in-reach opportunities for teachers to come to the museum and have unique experiences for them and their students.
Well, it's interesting, too, because not only are you connected to every classroom, but you're also connected to other scientific institutions like NASA, and you can bring all of that to the museum and then to each of those classrooms.
Right, yeah. So the NASA partnership has been going on for over 10 years. We just had Astronomy Days. And that is very exciting because when the astronauts come and when they're doing presentations at the museum, then we can beam them, the astronauts, their conversations into classrooms. I think one of the, in December when we had E.O. Wilson at the museum doing a global town hall, it was totally exciting. He wanted to particularly speak to teens about getting them involved in saving the biodiversity of the planet. So we had teens in the audiences there in the SECU Daily Planet, but we also were connected to schools across North Carolina and schools across the world. So in these global town halls that we can do now, we can connect to hundreds and thousands of people at one time about, you know, real important subjects. And that's what the new wing has enabled the museum to do is have a global impact as well as a statewide impact.
With, you know, sort of modern technology and the way we can connect in the ways you've just described, what then is the importance or the role, and does it change, of a location like that museum in the heart of Raleigh?
Because it's, again, you know, when you walk into the museum and you have a conversation with a researcher and they're right there in their lab, or you're standing in front of the window on animal health and you're seeing veterinarians and veterans doing a snake exam. I know at the 24-hour opening, at about 2 in the morning, they were doing acupuncture on a bearded dragon, which is this huge lizard that's about a foot long. And it was just staying there real still, like, oh, this is feeling better. You know, that's really cool. And so you, the visitor, can have a conversation with the veterinarian while they're performing these. And so these are, in many instances, they set off light bulbs and students' eyes. Oh, I could do that. I mean, I was standing at that window in animal health, and a young kid about 8 o'clock turned to his dad and said, you know, I've decided I want to be a veterinarian. You know, so I think these kinds of experiences, and you go into the investigate labs, and you're working with researchers and educators in those labs, and you're actually doing current research activities. And you learn at a very early age that you can be a scientist, this is not that hard, that it's fun, that it's interesting, and you can make discoveries.
One of the things that has always drawn adults and kids to museums has been the dinosaur.
Right.
And our dinosaur has an interesting story, how that first one got here. The dinosaur auction. We lost one, and then we finally made the big hit.
That's right. Yeah, that's one of the highlights of my career is when I had a museum supporter call me about a week before they were going to auction the dinosaur named Sue and said, well, is the museum going to go bid on that dinosaur? And I said, well, I don't think so. We've got $4 million to raise for exhibits, and my understanding is that the dinosaur is going to go from anywhere to $1 to $7 million. And he said, well, think about it. So I actually went to the Friends of the Museum and the board, and we called around. And within a week, we had raised $7.2 million. So they put me on a plane with our board chairs, John McMillan and Ann Smith and Joyce Fitzpatrick and our leading paleontologist, Dale Russell, and we flew to New York to bid on the dinosaur named Sue. And when we bid $5 million, everybody cheered because we were the only museum still in the bidding. There were two people hiding up in some classrooms up above, and people wanted this dinosaur to be in a public museum. Well, as it turned out, we dropped out at $7.2 million, and the Field Museum of Chicago got Sue. But we met the person that owned the Acrocanthosaurus and said, we've got a dinosaur for you. It roamed North Carolina, unlike the T-Rex.
A local dinosaur.
And so we went to South Dakota and to see the Acrocanthosaurus, perfect skull. Dale Russell, our paleontologist, was totally excited. She said, yeah, this is the dinosaur. So our funder stayed with us. And they purchased the dinosaur for the people of North Carolina, and we put it in that exhibit.
Oh,
that's totally
great.
Cool.
It's local, no antibiotics, no hormones.
Right,
so it's perfect
right,
for us, really.
Right, right.
How great. And you had the money in your pocket because everybody came up with within a week.
Yeah. So that's the kind of support the museum. That was private support. People saying, yes, we want to get a dinosaur for the people of North Carolina, and it needs to be in this museum. It's just totally cool.
Exhibits, because of the interactive nature of this and the fact that people on the floor really need to be good at explaining this and working with the public, are there criteria for exhibits, some that would work and some that just might not work so well in a place like yours?
Sure. So you go through, you know, we spent in the main museum 4 years developing exhibits. On the new wing, we spent, again, I guess, 4 to 5 years developing. And so there's some exhibits that didn't make it in. One, you don't have enough room to put in all the ideas. But the focus was in the Nature Research Center was to have exhibits that highlighted current scientific research. So one reason why you can get in a submersible and take a virtual tour 2,000 feet below the ocean surface is because we've been working with NOAA to do research off the coast of North Carolina now for over 10 years. And our researchers get in a submersible with researchers from around the world and go 2,000 feet and study the deep water corals. So we've simulated that actual scientific research in that exhibit. So that's kind of one of the criteria. And it needed to be cool, you know, needed to be current scientific research. So,
well, so you've got that going for you. I think the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences is one of the top 10 in the country, is
right.
it not, these days? And yet of those top 10, I bet it's one of the very few that remains free.
Right, right. And I think that is so important. And it goes back to my philosophy, is that every kid needs to have the opportunity to learn. And the state of North Carolina has supported for 133 years the state science museum and history museum and art museum being free, because so many school children from around the state come and enjoy these museums and their families. And also I think it makes economic sense, because a lot of people come and they come to free museums and then they spend money in the economy. And we had over 1.2 million visitors this year to the museum, and that's a record for us. And so that's, so it's not only a great science museum, but it's a economic driver and it's a tourist attraction.
1.2 million visitors last year, and I think the first year you were there, how many?
Okay, so when I first got to the museum in 1990, there was over about 200,000 visitors. So we've come a long way.
A few more people. All right, so you're free now. What are you doing these days?
Well, actually, I have been, I taught a leadership class at Duke last week. I've been traveling with my husband, Walter Bennett, on his book tour.
Leaving Tuscaloosa.
Leaving
a
Tuscaloosa.
Wonderful book. Yeah.
And we're getting ready to go to Vietnam in a couple of weeks, for a couple of weeks.
Just to hang out? Or are you going to look
well,
for exhibits while you're there? You can't stop.
When we were first married, Walter actually had a tour of duty in Vietnam. Yeah. And for years, we've talked about going back, and or him going back and me going for the first time. So we're, it's a vacation, and we're looking forward to that experience.
Safe travels, Betsy. Thanks so much, and thanks for being on the program.
Thank you so much. It's been a great time.
Betsy Bennett, the director for the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences for more than 20 years, retired in December of 2012. And our guest today on The State of Things, which you can find at stateofthings.org. Our program directed by Alex Granados, produced by Sean Wen, Nicole Campbell, and Dave DeWitt. Christina Blyde is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.